peace for 10 long years. My men, as you can see, said he, have submachine guns, and I can assure you they know how to use them, as well as the guards inside the stadium. They are guards outside, too. In fact, the whole place is ringed with troops, so don't harbor any illusions about any armed help from outside. Your friends will be stopped before they get anywhere near the place. In any case, the guards will finish you off inside in a couple of minutes. Is that clear? To be quite honest, not really. What make-believe world was it which our prince lived? What military units were going to arrive at the Estadio Chile to free the prisoners? Later we realized that the prince's outpourings, ostensibly designed to impress us, in fact were calculated to impress his own men. For the soldiers heard from their commander something that fitted in well with what they had dined into their ears earlier. What they had been told was that they were going to fight enemy troops with whom they were yet to make contact. That's how they were gotten into this bloody mess. That when the enemy had retreated, the bodies of civilians had been left lying on the battlefield. That those kept in the stadium had been taken prisoner. But a clash with the main body of enemy troops was inevitable. Hence the strict security precautions. Those fighting in the army of Chile, fighting their own people and families, had been tricked by their officers. The prince's speech was long and interrupted by his frequent absences. He would return each time, however, to pick up where he left off, and then he would turn up at other spots around the stadium and address prisoners on the upper our side stands. It must have been a miserable life for him, though, all these hours of talking. He was one of the few officers who tried to keep their vocabulary free of dirty words, and he sought to speak with an easy flow, without hesitations. Nonetheless, he was threatening and merciless. It was amazing how many of these officers used filthy obscenities, in that it was a church-related takeover. Pinochet was a great supporter of the church. It was supposed to be a religious cleansing of atheistic communism from Chile. Foreign garbage at a trot towards the exit. Form in a single file, said he. About 100 arrested foreigners get to their feet in the corner where they are kept away from us. They line up in a single file, put their hands on the wall, and set their legs apart. They have learnt the technique now well these days. The prince saunters leisurely behind their backs, whipping their genitals with consummate proficiency with his rifle butt. Now to double back to where you were, he personally welcomed every new batch of detainees arriving at the stadium, beating their genitals in the same fashion. That's the end of the trade unions, gentlemen. The end of disorder. Now we've got to work and to produce. All meetings and demonstrations are banned. We'll not tolerate the presence of foreigners in our country either. We don't need foreign garbage, do we? We'll let them foul their own nest back home. You heard that foreign garbage, didn't you? The Chilean race is a noble and beautiful race. We must purify our blood of all low-grade admixtures which once put us on the path towards degeneration. Down with the Jews and Negroes. Yes, gentlemen, I can assure you we'll bury the Jews and Negroes and Marxists forever. And you despicable Marxists had better remember that. I don't know what they are going to do with you eventually, but while you are in my hands, I'll teach you a lesson you'll never forget. There's no difference between day and night in the basement of the Estadio Chile. That kind of cry that I just gave was word for word verbatim. That's what you'll hear from U.S. police and military officers when they round up blacks and browns in USA, and it's just around the corner. As the writer said, there is no difference between day and night in the basement of the Estadio Chile. The blinding effect of electric lights on the ceiling and walls is made worse by the intense beams of searchlights directed on our faces, ravaged by several nights of sleeplessness. It was only when we went to the toilets outside the main entrance that we learnt whether it was daylight or night. The third night in succession without sleep accentuated the nervous tension so much so that our frayed nerves reacted to the slightest irritation by light or sound. And the awesome racist fascist prince talked on and on. Now he would order the foreigners to form up again, and the soldiers felt their genitals to check whether they were sufficiently swollen after the prince's working over them with his whip. Now he would order six soldiers to empty their magazines into the ceiling. He was fulfilling his promise to teach us a lesson we would never forget, and indeed, we felt we never would. We never would want to forget. For instance, we would never forget that Thursday, or was it Friday, when a man in a light-colored suit and white shirt sitting at the end of the first row in his sleep, let his legs stretch across the passage. Six soldiers were walking past. The first soldier stumbled, and those following him had to stop. The man woke up as if from a jolt and froze motionless, grasping the armrests of a chair. He was stained. He has stained, Your Honor, cried the prince, who was watching from the other end of the room. Get even with him. The man was asleep, didn't even know what he was doing. The soldier turned around and hit the man in the face. The man, blinded by blood, grabbed the soldier's rifle, trying to tear it away from him. The other five soldiers, stepping back a few paces, formed a semicircle and pointed their rifles at the detainee sitting nearby. We'll shoot anyone who moves. The heavy machine guns on the corners were swiveled around to keep us covered. The detainees in the center of the stadium slowly sank back in their seats. Everybody watched the proceedings. The man, he was around 50, and thinning on top, was still clinging to the rifle. That's my kind of man. Trying to keep its butt away from him. Blood was gushing out of his mouth. The soldier gave a violent yank which pulled the man out of his seat, and then hit him with his knee in the groin, in his privates. The man doubled up, and in desperation threw his fist towards his enemy's chin. It connected. The steel helmet flew off the soldier's head and landed on the floor noisily, as if it were a tin can. Bravo for that kind of dignity. That's Red Brigade dignity. I hope that's people's temple dignity. At least I know it would be for some. For a moment, the soldier was at a loss, and his youthful, pimpled face expressed a mixture of blind fury, pain, and fear that a 50-year-old-plus man could do this to him. The other soldiers pounced on the man and knocked him off his feet with their rifles. Leave them to fight it out, man to man, yelled the prince impatiently. Young hooligan soldiers picking on a 50-year-old man. The soldiers, minus his helmet, blood trickling down his tunic, kicked the lying man in his face again and again. More blood was now bespattering the light blue suit. More blood spurted out as the man grabbed at the soldier's feet again, trying to down him. That's the kind of stuff that communists are made of. But then apparently the man who had been stunned by the rifle butt blows lost consciousness, and now the soldiers could use his rifle butt without opposition. Holding his rifle with both hands, the soldier struck blow after blow at the man's head with the butt, inflicting deep wounds. The white of the cranial bone now showed above the man's crushed ear, and the soldier was still beating him with the rifle butt. But oh, who really had the victory? It was the 50-year-old that resisted the fascist pigs. Their guns, remember? The gun butt that was beating him till the bone showed in his brain was paid for by your tax dollars when you bought Coca-Cola or went to movies or bought a McDonald's hamburger. I bought a car. The man still appeared to be holding to the soldier's feet, and the latter stepped up the frequency of his rifle butt blows, putting his entire strength into them. Before long, the butt split into splinters. The unconscious man rolled down the steps. The soldiers pursued him, still beating him with what was left of the rifle butt. In the complete silence that descended, in which one could hear the other men breathed, the sound of metal crushing bone was clearly audible. The rifle was now smeared with matter and bone and spurted out of the fractured skull of the dead man. But that's the way to die. Don't take no shit from fascist pigs. With his eyes closed, the soldiers administered several more blows after the man was dead. Then, tossing what was left of the rifle aside, he covered his ears with his hands and went into a hysterical sobbing as he looked at what he had done in fulfillment of the prince's orders. So who really suffered? The young man that killed the brave 50-year-old man. But now, hysterically sobbing, he had to go on living. The man, so brave, who resisted, was dead. No more pain. He'd been true to communism. The other five soldiers picked him up quickly and carried him out of the room. the clenched fists of the dead man lying on the steps, never unloosened. Clenched fist, even while he was dead. The work-hardened palms were turned upwards, though finally when they opened his palms toward where the beams of the searchlights that flooded the spot with light throughout the incident were coming. The 9-year-old boy was killed far more quickly soon afterwards. The boy jumped off his seat and began running up the stairs, whereupon he collided with a soldier and, on falling, touched his rifle. The guard, who was twice as tall and broad as a lad, simply put the rifle against the boy's chest and pulled the trigger 3 times against his own young fellow countryman, a 9-year-old boy. That's fascism. While you indulge yourself about your love life or who doesn't love who and who's fucking who, and stand like pigs in the food line, worrying about your petty little problems, your jealousies, your constant concern with your own problem, this is what's happening all over the world, where USA still holds the boot of imperialism. Union of South Africa, Rhodesia, Somalia, Iran, Turkey. I could go on and on. The 2 bodies in different places were proof enough that the prince made no idle threats. They were put on full view of everybody for several hours, and only then doctors in white aprons turned up to certify their deaths. They were followed by stretcher bearers, flaming idiots. We will not tolerate any protests or disobedience. I'll shoot anyone who disobeys my orders, the prince screamed at the top of his voice. Haven't you understood that now you are nothing and nobody? You are the same as prisoners of war. You are garbage, stinking filth. Even animals are above you, socialist and communist and niggers. One of the detainees climbed onto the banisters, threw up his hands and shouted, Long live President Allende! Down with fascism! And then plummeted from a height of 30 feet to his death. He died in the arms of his comrades, who picked up his broken body. His body was also left lying for many hours in full view of the defenseless prisoners, who were petrified with horror. Why should they be? He was another brave one. He couldn't take intimidation from fascists. He could at least have his honor, so he leaped to his death and didn't know whether he'd be crippled. 30 feet's not a very far distance, but he lifted his clenched fist and said, Long live President Allende, down with fascism, and plummeted from the height of 30 feet to his death. To cow the detainees into complete submission and show that he meant business, the prince ordered his men to fire shots into the ceiling. Before long, the air was filled with the smoke of cordite, and pieces of plaster rained down from the bullet-riddled ceiling. He also ordered us to lie under our seats, while those on the football pitch were ordered to lie on the turf face down. The sound of firing came from the streets. Those were some of the lessons we were not to forget. On Friday night, 9 comrades, unable to stand the strain, went out of their minds. They were shot. Lack of sleep made everything more chaotic, and any sort of daily routine was impossible. As soon as we began dropping off to sleep, the prince ordered us to get on our feet and exchange places and then get back to where we were. I don't know whether this bothers you, but I'm not even slightly moved. No fascist would get me provoked to madness or anything else but to take them by the throat like the good man in blue did in his 50s and make them kill him. If you're fearful, you better work on yourself and analyze yourself, as all are required in Jonestown to be listening, and I do mean so. We tried to dull the pangs of hunger by drinking. They gave us some bad coffee and beans once a day, but not enough of either to go around. Most of us went hungry. That's why we drank water. One of the detainees fainted, clasping his stomach and groaning as he fell. In due course, the prince was informed that some of his detainees were fainting from hunger. He reacted by ordering his saucepan full of lentil soup to be emptied onto the floor, with the comment, That's for those who want some more. They must lap it up off of the floor. One morning the prince was replaced by Major Acuna. When this reserved man with voice horse from heavy smoking was in command, the detainees were treated distinctly better. Major Acuna, it would be said, I think, in Portuguese or in Spanish also, closely supervised the delivery and distribution of bread, half a loaf per person. Later we saw him at the Estadio Nacional reading out lists of those who were being released. None of us had ever heard words of encouragement from him, but then he never insulted anybody either. Then one day, Major Acuna disappeared. It was rumored at the stadium that he'd been involved in a road accident. He was too kind to the prisoners. After a brief absence, the prince would return and would make more speeches. And every time he first addressed the foreigners, whom he ordered to form up against the wall with their hands on the wall and their legs apart, and he repeated his ritual, first he would stroke the genitals of each of his victims with his whip, and then use the whip savagely, beating them, the privates mercilessly. Before long, the toilets were filled to overflowing with excrement, means shit, waste, BM, and stinking streams of urine flowed along the passages. In one of those cold and stinking passages where some of the detainees were kept, we saw Victor Jara, the composer and singer. He was sitting on a chair. His face was calm. We exchanged greetings, as I'll be finishing in a moment. Put Victor Jara on, have him ready. Next day he was still there. His forehead was crisscrossed with fresh scars, but he was calm, and he still smiled the same familiar smile we all knew so well. On Monday, September 10, I had seen him at our radio station. He was playing back one of his recent recordings, Hymns of the Building Worker. Here at the Estadio Chile, he spent his last hours. When we were shifted to the Estadio Nacional, Victor Jara had already been murdered by the prince and his men. Shocked by this terrible news, people incarcerated in a concentration camp broke into his songs. We believed that we would still be singing these songs and hearing others sing them when we were fighting to open the new roads along which liberated Chileans would march into a bright future. But sang them they did, in spite of their torturous condition from lack of food and water and the terrible physical tortures they'd been put through. On Sunday, September 16, the detainees at the Estadio Chile began to be evacuated and shifted to the Estadio Nacional, where the investigation procedure would be speeded up. The Estadio Chile, packed as it was, to overflowing, the members of the military tribunal lacked suitable working conditions. On Monday, September 17, only 1 week after the military takeover that was brought about by USA, it's been in every USA paper that Kissinger gave $9 million from the President of the United States alone to have Allende murdered. So it's not my word. Even U.S. press agrees. On Monday, September 17, at the latest, we were told we would be released as we would have to resume work on Monday. This is what Colonel Espinoza promised us on his first visit to us. That was one of the first false official statements. Later, so many others followed in quick succession we couldn't remember. In single file, hands on the back of our heads, we trotted out into the street, almost touching with our elbows the minibuses standing along the curb. We got into the buses with a sense of relief at the welcome change. There was a glorious sunset. To think only a week earlier, the sunset had come on a free Chile. Down on the floor, you stinking bastards, sons of bitches. This from the carabiner behind the driving wheel. Lie down on the aisle and under the seats. Don't imagine you're being taken for a pleasure drive. And to think that these bastards had ideas of ruling this country, you presumptuous scum, sons of bitches. We arrive at the Estadio Nacional without catching so much as a glimpse of what is happening in the streets. All we saw was the rusty floor of the minibus and the shining boots of the soldiers, the shining boots that had been provided by U.S. tax dollars that you helped pay. You in Jonestown, where their intellect presumably resided, with their shiny boots, that is, worn to a shadow by 5 days of semi-starvation and a lack of sleep, we move along like so many ghosts, quite oblivious, unaware of the asinine chatter and clowning of the green uniforms the green doorway provided again by the USCIA. We cannot even slap their faces, much as we would like to. We are 20, but guarded by 40 bayonets. The soldiers jeer at us, treating us with a haughty air. We are mourning the death of those they have killed, and we are bitter at the thought that our government has been overthrown by these bastards. We burn with shame at the farce put on by the prince. Only in racialist Hitler's Germany could foreigners be subjected to such wanton cruelty and treated with such cynicism. The only foreigners mistreated were Cubans and Soviets, not the USA imperialists, not the monopoly capitalists. The prince repeatedly emphasized that we would never forget the lesson he was giving us. He was right, we never would. We would always remember those 100 foreigners who were taunted and humiliated by a regime that was not ours, although also Chilean, but actually put in power by USA imperialism. The point is that those foreigners were seized, mishandled, and humiliated in our country. Whatever has happened to us is of no importance in this context. We are at home, and the day will come when we'll wash our dirty linen clean. But we'll never forget or forgive anything, you, Prince, least of all. Thousands of Chileans saw you well and remember your face down to the last wrinkle. We shall recognize you, even if you change into civilian clothes, grow long hair, beard, and a mustache. And should you go into hiding, we'll seek you out. You and others of your kind will have to pay dearly for each blow you administered to little children. For every humiliation you inflicted on others, murderer, you are a traitor to your country. You have stained your flag and your uniform. You shall have no peace until you have yelped your last, Princess Bastard. This is something for you not to forget, too, Prince. Now, as we hear these moments of reflection, let's remember Victor Hara. In one of those cold and stinking passages where some of the detainees were kept, we saw Victor Hara, the composer and singer, a communist that would not give one secret of any of his confederates, and died through the most horrible tortures. He was sitting on a chair. His face was calm. We exchanged greetings. Next day, he was still there. His forehead was crisscrossed with fresh scars, but he was calm and he still exchanged the same smile, that familiar smile we all knew so well. Now let us listen to Victor Hara. I love you. Grow up.